Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The assassination of Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah is a momentous event. As a tactic, Israel has been winning one battle after another. But is murdering resistance leaders a good strategy? Speaking of tactics and strategy, how did Zelensky's U.S. trip go? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Istanbul, we have Tariq Zerilamar. He is a historian and political commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with George in Budapest. I've known you a long time. This has probably been one of the momentous last few days of our political lifetime. The murder of Hezbollah's leader, widely regarded as a major power broker, not only in Lebanon, but throughout the greater Middle East. Israel's winning some battles here. What does this portend, George?
Well, you're right, Peter. Israel is winning some major battles there, and it is stunning what has happened during the past week to 10 days. Because this was a series of Israel's decapitation attacks against the Hezbollah leaders. No one was really expecting this. So it started with the pager attacks and then went to the walkie-talkie attacks. Then there was the attack on Ahmed Jibril. And then we had the huge attacks in Lebanon and culminating in the assassination of Nasrallah. It looks now as if the entirety of Hezbollah's leadership has been eliminated. Now, the that doesn't mean Hezbollah has gone, at least as far as we can tell. But this is a major blow that Israel has inflicted on Hezbollah, and one has to then think, well, what's next? I think an invasion of Lebanon is almost certainly on the cards. They will invade and I think take the, you know, take the southern part of Lebanon, you know, maybe, you know, move up to the Litani River and just simply have this as a buffer zone, a demilitarized buffer zone, and that which will be under Israeli occupation. I think that's almost certain would happen. But there is a real warning, and Netanyahu issued this warning to Iran. You say, hey, we did this to Hezbollah, we can do this to you. And I think that could well happen. I mean, they could well start targeting major figures in Iran in the hope of provoking an Iranian response, knowing, and this is because of all the nonsense coming from Washington, knowing that America would come in on Israel's side if Iran attacks Israel in retaliation. So that's really the strategy. And, you know, we don't even know what would happen in Iran in such circumstances. But it does look like, I mean, you were saying this, Peter, some time ago, that Israel seizes this opportunity as a really big chance to sort out a lot of problems all at once.
Tariq, the footage coming out of the last few days from Lebanon, particularly Beirut, it defies imagination. I mean, it's hard to believe it's even real. But this is what's been going on in Gaza. Do you think that this Israeli offensive in Lebanon is going to mirror what has been happening in Gaza? I mean, because it looks absolute. Because, you know, we hear that Hamas has to be destroyed, but what we've seen is a lot of civilian casualties. Now we're seeing Hezbollah has to go. We're seeing a lot of civilian casualties. Are they going to mirror? Go ahead.
I think they are perfectly capable of that, morally capable.
Oh, only with U.S. help, though.
As I said, morally capable. And unfortunately, they're militarily capable of that, as you say, because of U.S. help. And look, before they did this to Gaza, this genocide, right, they told us they would do it. And they have told us that about Lebanon several times. We have heard announcements over months, quite literally from leading Israeli politicians that, look out, we can do the same thing to Lebanon. So it's definitely a possibility, unfortunately. And unfortunately, we also know from the experience of Gaza and the Palestinians in general that the West will not stop them, will not restrain them, and will help them do it if they choose to do it. I think that the strikes that have done great damage to Hezbollah, I agree with George, have been at least equally aimed at civilian casualties and disruption. I think there are several calculuses here in play on the Israeli side, because devilish as they are, they're thinking these things through. And okay. I think one thing they wanted is create an alternate wave of refugees inside Lebanon to destabilize the country further. And they also want an alternate wave of refugees inside the capital city, because the capital city, as many big cities, has rather different quarters, right? And as you know, Lebanon is a confessionally, ethnically complicated society, and they're attacking poorer and more Shiite quarters in the south now, and they're making these people displace into the center and other places in Beirut. So I think social disruption, sowing dissension and tension within Lebanon as a whole and within Beirut as a whole, is also part of this nefarious Israeli strategy. I don't want to take too much time. I would like to add one thing. I entirely agree that they have unfortunately been very successful again in their evil. But, you know, anti-colonial resistance struggles tend to take a very long time. And yeah. The people who say, well, Nasrallah is dead, well, Ho Chi Minh died before the Vietnam War ended. You know, a lot of people forget that. And it was not, in the end, necessary to bring it too close. South Vietnam, the proxy, is gone, and the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese internal resistance won the war in the end, right? So this is, it's too early to tell, but it's very clear that Israel has done a lot of damage.
Absolutely. But George, I mean, I messaged you back and forth yesterday talking about tactics and strategy, and that's really what I want to talk about here. And, you know, yes, these successful wins, taking out leaders and whatnot. But, I mean, it's the calculus that I think we're seeing unfold is that war is the aim. It's not looking for a specific outcome. It is just to continue to have a conflict. I mean, it's very interesting looking at Gaza. I mean, Netanyahu has failed in Gaza. Well, yeah, Hamas is still there, but Gaza's destroyed. It's a complete shambles, okay? So it doesn't really matter if Hamas is still right there. This is the same game plan with American help. No red lines apply here. But that doesn't create political facts on the ground that are that can have substance for the long term. We're in the always living in the present of war, George.
Yes, I agree. I should just say that the Hezbollah leader that Israel killed a few days ago was Ibrahim Akil. I confused it with another name. But to me, you're absolutely right, Peter, that what Israel is doing is reorganizing the Middle East. And of course, yes, you can say that, well, they can't ultimately crush the resistance, but they can give a damn good try, because ultimately, you know, these forces that we had assumed were really powerful, and that they've now built up an alternative set of structures in the Middle East to rival Israel, which namely Hezbollah, Iran, and the various other Iranian proxies, you know, they've been hit very, very hard. And keep in mind, it's not just what happened to Hezbollah, but Iran's lack of action for a long time now. I mean, the Iran's strange passivity in the face of repeated Israeli attacks.
Iran's actions were coordinated with the United States and other
places. Exactly. So, and then, of course, we were expecting some kind of an Iranian response to the killing of Anir, the leader of Hamas. So that didn't come. And then surprisingly, the other day, we had the new Iranian president talking about returning to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as if somehow he can make nice with the West. So, we're getting a situation where is the resistance? And here we have Israel, absolutely ruthless. You know, they made clear that they are ready to do anything, kill as many people, destroy as much as they need to ensure their safety. They've shown that they have no respect at all for anybody else's opinions. And so really, well, what can stop Israel? I mean, there's no power in the region that can stop Israel. There's no great power that can intervene to do something about Israel. So you know, yes, the resistance will continue, but ultimately, what is the point of the resistance? As you're saying, well, Gaza's gone. There's no more Gaza. You know, there may be some surviving remnants of Hamas, but ultimately, they've destroyed Gaza. And then, you know, they could easily move on to the West Bank. And I think then, you know, they're going to move on to Lebanon and they'll just simply occupy a part of Lebanon and that's it. So.
Yeah, but I mean, George, you're absolutely right. But Tariq, does that give Israel security?
No, absolutely not. Not in the long run. Look, the current Israeli model of achieving security would be kill everyone around us and occupy everything. They would have to complete, not just commit, complete multiple genocides to get security they're trying the way they're trying it now. And that, of course, even they won't be able to do. They would probably like to do that, but they won't be able to do that over time. Look, again, I entirely agree about the way in which Israel has the axis of resistance, right, now pinned in a very bad place. Because on one side, the Israelis have delivered these humiliating attacks on them, not only devastating, but humiliating. And on the other side, they have put them in a place where they have to respond or lose credibility, right? You can see the imprint of this actually in our discussion, which is very natural. We are already saying, oh my God, look, they can't even strike back. Where are they, right? And this will happen to a lot of people. And I think this is part of the Israeli calculus as well. And unfortunately, to an extent, it is bound to work. But I would add one thing. Look, we would ask, what is the point of resistance if they can't strike back? I would give two answers. First of all, the point of resistance sometimes is to survive until you have better circumstances, right? What's the point of the resistance in France in 1943? It's to wait until the landing in 1944, when you can really strike, right? I know it's a faint analogy, but still. The other thing is, Israel is such a brutal country that for a lot of people it affects and who survive. The question is not our question. It's not what's the point. The question is retaliation. It's revenge. You have to consider that every time Israel does this, they will create a lot of people. When you tell them your resistance is futile, their answer would be, you know what? I don't care anymore as long as I get to kill some of them. Right? And that Israel is also constantly setting in motion. So it's not that simple in the end, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, also we're in the moment, we're in the present and we're looking at it. But again, anti-colonial resistance movements last a very long time. I think the Crusaders were in the Levant for about 123 years, and then they weren't. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here and we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter LaBelle. Remind you, we're discussing some real news. George, I want to finish up our discussion on events playing out in Lebanon. Nasrallah was a very well-known character. Even his enemies admitted he was charismatic. And he was not just a religious fanatic or a terrorist. He was a lot of things to a lot of people. And he will be remembered for a very long time. One of the things when you have an event like this of such a historic figure, one can ask themselves, is the person that comes after him is going to be more determined, take more risks, meaning was he the moderate that they're going to miss one day, George?
Well, that's a very good question, Peter, and we really don't know because, you know, you could have situations in which the new leader will go off on a very different tack. I mean, remember, we assumed when Nasser died that his successor would follow a very similar policy to Nasser's, but in fact, Sadat, you know, did a 180-degree turn and completely abandoned Nasser's. So we don't know what would happen. But Nasrallah obviously was a very powerful, a very dominant figure within Hezbollah. And one who's clearly a very realistic person. I mean, this is no blowhard. No, you know, wasn't just emptily thundering against the Zionists. So he would give a very realistic presentation of the situation and the weaknesses and vulnerabilities of Israel's opposition. And in fact, you know, all of this time, you know, we had been expecting something more from Hezbollah than what he had given. But evidently, he thought that, well, we really don't want to provoke a huge war with Israel. And I think Nasrallah, I think, you know, he was right that Hezbollah really wasn't in any you know, fit condition to fight against Israel. But you ultimately still have to ask whether, and then, you know, I'm really just speculating here, but whether these religious leaders, whether Nasrallah, whether the religious leaders in Iran, have a sufficient grasp of the realities of the world, you know, that maybe just they're too absorbed in their theology to realize who they're up against. You know, the people that they're up against are absolutely ruthless, that they're ready to do anything. And I'm talking about Israel and the United States. And, you know, maybe I somehow would, you know, they're going to spend the last few years preparing in a much more much vigorous and strong-minded way to take on Israel. Maybe a secular leader might have been more successful.
Patrick, the same question to you, because up to 60 to 80,000 Israeli residents of northern Israel are still not back in their homes. For all we know, most of Hezbollah's arsenal is still intact, because, you know, you can decapitate the leadership, which apparently it looks like that's the case here, but their infrastructure is still there. So it's still a potent force. That's why I'm asking about who comes next, Tariq.
Yeah, obviously, I only have heard some rumors that are, you know, being published. But in principle, right, the question is also, is Israel going to launch a ground invasion, right? Because if it does launch a ground invasion into the south of Lebanon, as you mentioned at the beginning, the conditions for Hezbollah's fight change. And we think that that will be responding more to Hezbollah's strengths. The problem, I think, for any new leadership is that if they settle at this point, which might be an option, might be, but probably the Israelis won't even give
and
them
that. And in that case, decoupling from the Gaza genocide.
Yes, they would be seen as betraying Gaza finally, and they would be seen as settling under conditions of being defeated. That would be the message at this point. And I think they know that as well. So one thing about leadership, of course, it's absolutely true that they have suffered horrific strikes and most of it has been removed. But it's also true that we know that all these leaders have deputies. That doesn't mean they're all ready to take over or all the same quality, not at all. But of course, it is an organization sophisticated enough so that if you strike at its head, it doesn't immediately collapse, right? It has the capacity to regenerate that to an extent. I think that's important to keep in mind as well.
Okay, George, I did mention in my introduction that we would comment on Mr. Zelensky's trip to America. It caused a lot of waves, probably waves that he really hadn't anticipated. And of course, calls that he was getting meddling in American politics wouldn't be for the first time. You and I have chronicled this all the way back to 2016. Did Zelensky return home a victor, or was he vanquished?
I don't think it was either, really. Okay. But there's no question that...
That's kind of a reflection of a muddled policy, but yeah, go ahead.
Right. But he does come across as a kind of a figure from a sitcom, you know, where something makes an appearance every few episodes, you know, wearing his his T-shirt and pants and, you know, he's getting... But everyone's already getting tired of him, and, you know, he's got his few lines, and everyone's already moving on to other things, but, you know, they're all very... But ultimately, he did clearly, flagrantly interfere in internal U.S. Politics, you know, with his trip to Pennsylvania, hanging out with all these Democratic Party bigwigs. And then, you know, his interview with the New Yorker, in which he said negative things, particularly about J.D. Vance and to a lesser extent about Trump. And then the meeting with Trump was really very, very inconsequential. You know, Trump did his usual saying, oh, yeah, you know, great guy. But he said, but I always had good relations with Putin. And so, you know, I'm going to get on the phone to try to sort this out. And when Zelensky made his, again, sitcom routine, well, I hope you have better relations with me than with Putin. He said, well, it takes two to tango. So I don't think this was particularly successful for him. And because, again, and from what we know publicly, I don't know that the White House committed itself in any way to his victory plan. But not, but given the situation in Washington, and given at least their commitment, continuing commitment to Ukraine, I don't think it was a disaster either.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that, I mean, when you look at the totality of your answer, at the very end, you talked about the so-called victory plan. Shouldn't have been at the top and not the bottom. See, that's the point here. Tariq, you know, from what we've, it still hasn't been revealed what the victory plan is. I mean, everybody's talking about it, but it doesn't seem like to have anything to do with victory and doesn't seem like much of a plan. The problem is for this administration, and very much so for Zelensky, his political legitimacy is zero. He's only kept afloat by Western support and Western money, Western arms. But, you know, this is a strategy that is kind of stillborn right now. In doubt, keep the war going. That's the strategy. Tariq.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. And as far as the victory plan is concerned, there is no such plan. I mean, Anatoly Shary, a very good Ukrainian blogger, who's of course in exile, right, has talked about this. Everything we hear about this mysterious plan amounts to, and we hear this, by the way, also in leaks from the American administration, it's another shopping or rather begging list. That's what this is. They've just written up stuff they want once again, and this time they call it the victory plan. And of course, because the military situation for the regime gets worse and worse and worse, these plans are more and more absurd. You know, it really reminds me of the Germans in winter 1944-45, you know, making victory plans. It's getting ridiculous. But the other thing, of course, here is that George is so right. The man is from a sitcom. He is, after all, that's where he came from. He comes literally from a comedy show, right? And now he is jumping the shark. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have died, and he's still on the same stupid routine that they taught him at the very beginning of this large-scale war, and he can't think of anything else, right? He has no new script. So I think that measured against what he needed, this was a defeat. I take George's point. I think George is objectively, so to speak, right, that it's sort of muddled in between. But if you hold it up against what he would need to sort of save him or whatever that is, it is clearly a defeat because he would need so much. I mean, look, ultimately, you could almost say that Zelensky's tragedy is that Ukraine is not Israel. The American support for Ukraine is really conditional and very mercenary, right? Whereas the American support for Israel, as the Americans say, is ironclad, right? Ukraine has never achieved this status and will never achieve this status.
And George, again, you know, the problem is here, when you look at this project, it's a Democrat Party project from day one, okay? The Republicans and all of their, you know, clutching their pearls. How dare you be partisan? I mean, if you hadn't noticed it, I don't know what your acumen when it comes to politics here. But the problem is here is that there's no peace plan. And you and I have been saying this from the very, very beginning. You shouldn't be talking about victory. Don't be, even if even defeat doesn't really kind of fit into the equation. Peace is what everybody needs. Peace is what everybody wants, but we can't get there, George.
Well, except that the United States really doesn't want peace. I mean, I think, and that's the true United States.
Well, they don't want peace for Russia, that's for sure. Right.
That's it, exactly. They basically want to keep it going at the way they're keeping it going, which is, you know, the arms manufacturers, you know, they're churning out their products, they're sending them there. Ukrainians are getting killed. Well, you know, no one cares about that. Russia, but the most important thing is the Russians are getting killed. You know, they keep going on killing Russians. So it's basically, let's keep the war going for a little bit longer. That's why they never spell out any kind of a peace deal that they would accept. You know, like, you know, NATO has never spelled out anything at all that's realistic, that in any way is attainable, probably because they fear that if they did, then, you know, actually that would stimulate negotiations to say, well, okay, if you're ready to accept this and we want that, then we can actually talk and find something in the middle. But they don't do anything like that. Instead, they make these absolutely unrealistic demands, like complete withdrawal of Russian forces, Ukraine within 1991 borders, and the Russian leaders surrender themselves to a war crimes tribunal. Well, this is unacceptable, and the NATO leaders know it's unacceptable. So that's why they can keep uttering this and keeping the war going in the hope that somehow Ukraine can go on fighting, can go on essentially dying.
One parting thought, gentlemen, is that seeing Zelensky standing next to Trump here, I just couldn't help but have the feeling that Zelensky is terrified, not for only for his country, because I don't think he cares much about his country, considering the carnage. He's worried about his own physical safety. And I will leave it there. I want to thank my guests in Istanbul and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.